Professor Joan Roughgarden is no ordinary biologist, and no ordinary trans woman either. Nowadays, she's most famous for her 2004 book, Evolution's Rainbow, an academic but popularly accessible work which challenges Darwin's theory of sexual selection. Her latest book, Evolution and Christian Faith, Reflections of an Evolutionary Biologist, which was published in 2006, shows that her willingness to take on controversial subjects is, if anything, stronger and more confident, despite the inevitable way in which her critics have responded to the first. Joan transitioned in 1998 at the age of 52. At that time, she had already been teaching at Stanford for over a quarter of a century and already had 3 books and over 100 academic articles and papers to her name. She owes her ability to continue through that transition in her life to no less a figure than Condoleezza Rice, now US Secretary of State, and arguably one of the most powerful women in the world. An encounter that Joan describes in the interview she agreed to give when we met at the University of East Anglia. I began by asking Joan about her family and social background. Joan, it's lovely to meet you, and it's wonderful that you've been able to get over to the UK right now. I was wondering if I could ask you first a little bit about yourself, because many people will know your name. Lots of people maybe don't, however. So if you can explain to me a little bit about your family history first.
And certainly. It's lovely to meet you as well. And thank you so much for getting in touch. And thank you so much for all the communication in the past years. So there's been a sense of solidarity, I think, between the transgender people in the U.S. and here in the U.K. and in many, and we admire the leadership and the progress that you've been able to make legislatively, which just isn't even on the horizon in the U.S. In part, of course, because we're so big, and it would have to be done state by state, but also. Just the vision of organization that you have in the UK is a source of deep and abiding envy for us in the US.
I'm going to have to edit this bit out, of course. But you live in San Francisco, is that right?
Yes, I live in San Francisco.
Is that where you were born, Greg?
No, I was born in New Jersey on the East Coast, but I grew up in Indonesia in the Philippine Islands. My father was a missionary, but not a priest, and he was working for the Episcopal Church as an architect and construction engineer, building churches and hospitals. And then he was working for the United Nations in Indonesia and building houses for personnel there. So I grew up in the tropics, and as a result, ever since, I really love hot, humid weather that most people can't stand, you know. But
what are you doing in Britain?
Shivering. And even San Francisco is a little cold for me, I must say. Then I went to university on the East Coast, and then moved to California in 1972, and I've been there now for quite a while, so I feel very much like a Californian. And I've always been in the San Francisco area and lived in downtown San Francisco now since 1999.
But it wasn't originally biology that you came to. I understand you were an oceanographer.
Oh, no, I was a biological oceanographer, so it's a division of oceanography. No, I've always been a biologist, and for about 1 week, I was actually pre-medicine, but I took one look at the people who were also pre-meds and decided I didn't want them as colleagues. But I stayed in biology. It's hard to explain why. I was basically encouraged when I was a first-year student and felt that because of the encouragement from the instructor at that time, a professor named Wolf Vishniak, who was a microbiologist, that I could make a career there. It just seemed like a place where I had something to offer. And then as it turned out, I went into the ecology evolution area of biology because it's the most theoretical area of biology. The problem with biology as a student is that so much of the material just requires memorization and not thinking. But ecology and evolution are the most conceptual and theoretical parts of biology, the most philosophical, if you will. And that's what's always attracted me. And I was able to take a lot of mathematics when I was in university. And yet, even though I'm known primarily as a mathematical or theoretical ecologist and evolutionist, on the aptitude tests, my verbal aptitude always turns out to be higher than my mathematical aptitude. And what it's amounted to is that I can explain equations in words. And I really have made a living by being able to teach math-phobic students math and how to teach biology majors mathematics.
You'll never go hungry in that case. I want to come back to this, obviously to the philosophical side of what you do in a moment. But I thought it'd be interesting to talk about the experience of transitioning as an academic and how you felt that went, how much support you got from your colleagues.
Well, this was in 98. And I've been preparing for it for a few years beforehand. It's pretty clear that no one had any experience with someone transitioning. And it pushed the envelope very clearly for my colleagues.
I understand this even involved Condoleezza Rice.
Yes, I was at Stanford University and still am. And Condoleezza Rice was the provost at that time. And I went to her because she was the chief academic officer, rather than to start lower down in the administration. Because if it was okay with her, then it would be okay down the line. And I didn't want her to be blindsided by this, that she had to be in a position to be the first to absorb and then to control the subsequent unfolding of events. And she was a truly wonderful person. She's extraordinarily intelligent. And I had composed this letter, and I had a little picture of myself as Joan. And so I waited. So I made an appointment with her, and then I actually waited in a chapel until the time came, and then I went out of the chapel to her. And I saw her reading the letter, and I could follow her eyes as she went from line to line, and she would nod. And then at the very end, I had summarized everything I had done at Stanford, and I asked her if I could remain on the faculty. And so she looked at me, and she said, "Yes, you may remain at Stanford." And which is a very interesting thing to do, because she could have said no. She had the power to say no. And even though I had tenure at the time, this was so extraordinary, I think, that I could have been forced out or given a golden parachute or something of that sort. And then she was so sweet. She looked at the picture and said, "You're a beautiful woman." And I thought that was so sweet of her. And throughout her career at the university, she's always had a very good sensitivity to different peoples and to diversity. And I hang out in very leftist circles, and I must say I'm the only person I know of who says good things about Condoleezza Rice. But the fact is, that's what I can report.
And it makes a lot of difference to know the human being sometimes, doesn't it?
Yes. And her own history is, of course, interesting, because the reason, in fact, she became a Republican was that the Democrats wouldn't have anything to do with her as a black girl, son of a preacher in the South somewhere, I don't remember, might have been Alabama. And it was at that time the Republicans were nowhere, and they would sort of take anybody. And they took her, and they've had her ever since. And if only the Democrats had been able to see the potential that she had, because, I mean, there's evident brilliance there. And, of course, all my friends, you know, condemn her for being a member of the Bush administration, which I appreciate, but I feel the Bush administration might be a good deal worse if it weren't for her. I mean, we don't have any controlled experiment in which we've seen what Bush would do without Rice there versus what Bush would do with Condoleezza Rice there. And
I have the feeling we're starting to toy with areas of controversy that put your biology controversy into the shade. If I just come on to that now, yeah. Then, I mean, you actually described in the early publicity for your first book, Evolution's Rainbow, this sort of road to Damascus epiphany moment of watching Pride, and just tell me about that.
Well, this was about the. Maybe the first year after I'd come out or something like that. It was about 19... Actually, might even have been the year before my transition. It might have been 1997, something like that. And I was marching in my first gay pride parade in San Francisco, which is a really gargantuan parade, and it's going to be next week. And I remember seeing, being impressed at the size of it. And a lot of people don't understand the sense of this. I concluded that if there's a theory that says there's something wrong with so many people, then maybe it's the theory that's wrong and not the people. And that's because, you know, I was aware that as a biologist, the scientific narratives that you get in the biology curriculum as well as throughout medicine about gender and sexuality variation is always negative and pathologizing. And as a naturalist, you don't. This raised a red flag, because if I were to go study a population of birds and I found that 10% of the birds had a yellow stripe, I wouldn't say, oh, that's a defective gene that they have which happens to give them yellow instead of brown. It's not as though there's a brown defective gene which is letting the yellow come through or something like that. And it would be my job as a naturalist to know what the social function was of the yellow stripe, you know, or whatever the trait is. That a truly deleterious trait is automatically very rare. If it were only 1 in 10,000 birds or 1 in 30,000 birds that had a yellow stripe, well, then you might be able to assume there was something strange. But when you're talking about what we would call a phenotype or a trait, which is present at around 10% to 1% of the population, that is far, far too common to be explained by some story of deleteriousness or maladaptation. And that's what was being done about gays and trans and so forth. And until the gay pride parade, I didn't viscerally sense how many people were gay and how many people were trans. And I had heard the numbers, you know, that 1 in 10 are gay or 1 in 5, something like that. But I didn't know that many people. I mean, it's not as though 10% of my friends were gay. Nor would I have known. I mean, one coming from the straight world doesn't know how many people really are gender and sexuality variant in one way or another. And the gay pride parade puts everybody out there. And then when you see 100,000 people, then you know that that very well could be 10% of the entire San Francisco population. And then you know that you cannot tell a negative story about this on the basis of science. You're doing your science wrong. And that was the moment. And I knew that if I could keep my job and so on, I was going to have to revisit the science of gender and sexuality and figure out just what was going on. And that then led eventually to Evolution's Rainbow.
Did you have any misgivings about that, knowing that obviously that's going to draw a lot of criticism, challenging that aspect of Darwin, and that people would personalize that in terms of your own gender history and say that you were talking from a position of bias and you weren't being objective?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I try to evade, actually, going directly in contradiction with Darwin on sexual selection, so that even in the preface of Evolution's Rainbow, I was being equivocal and I was trying to say, well, Darwin may have been right about the peacock, but he's not right very often, you know, and I was trying to take a position which would give the sexual selectionist some space, but kind of locate it as being unusual or not the general case, but just less common than originally imagined, but nonetheless correctly explained by Darwin. But by the time I got to the chapter in Evolution's Rainbow where I was summarizing the diversity, then I just simply, so to speak, put my beer on the table and said, you know, I've got to call it the way it is here, and Darwin's probably wrong on the peacock too. And so I knew this would be a more or less untenable position. Certainly politically it's untenable. But we keep coming back to the fact, how do you compromise on a contradiction? How do you compromise on...
This is a bit like declaring that the world is not flat, isn't it?
Yes. So we'll see how it plays out. I mean, it's still early, and the sexual selection advocates are going to have to deal with accounting for the diversity and accounting for the contradictions and accounting for all of the cases in which the sexual selection story is now collapsing. And they're welcome to continue supposing that they can fix it up. But as I've said sometimes before, you've heard it from me first. Do you want to throw good money after bad, or do you want to rethink this? And it's their choice.
Obviously, the prominence that you've been given because of this work also inevitably projects you as a more visible person in terms of the whole transgender politics arena in the United States as well. Can you tell me your impression of how that differs from say, the UK, and also how it's progressing?
Well, I don't know how it differs from the UK, so that's one of the interesting things here, is for me to get more of a sense of the transgender environment here. In my feeling about the transgender agenda is that, and from the very beginning, of course, as you point out, in order to evade the criticism of sexual selection theory, The first comeback is that I have an agenda, a trans agenda. And so we need to be clear about what that is, and also what their agenda is. Because the other side has an agenda too, which they usually won't own up to and they usually won't discuss. And so the trans agenda that I have is not political, it's intellectual. And the comparison would be between in the U.S., for example, the role of blacks in baseball has not been to change baseball, but simply to prosper within baseball. And I suppose it would be the same for cricket in India and in the West Indies, where the game of cricket hasn't changed, but you have a broader group of people playing cricket than in the early colonial days or whatever. But on the other hand, if we look at music, we see that blacks have actually changed music. They've made the blues, they've made jazz, and in Jamaica, for example, they've made reggae. And I think that the whole LGBT movement so far has not really changed the intellectual landscape very much. A lot of us in the, you know, in the wider gay community are talking to one another. And I think that the agenda, therefore, is to influence the intellectual landscape from our location, but the broad intellectual, to make statements that affect the center, but make them from a marginal location, if you know what I'm saying.
And finally, Joan, I'm going to ask you, if you could have had your time again and not been trans, would you wish that were so?
Well, it's hard. I mean, I don't think about that. I do know that I value my womanhood in a deeper sense, I think, than many women who just take it for granted. And not unlike, you know, an immigrant who values their citizenship more than someone born natively. And it's a hard call because, obviously, having lived for a while as a man, that gave me access to training and to a position that women would not have been able to access because of the prejudice in the workplace against women.
Which is quite a big prejudice in academia, isn't it?
Yes, and so I think that the job now is to use that location for good. So that's why I really can't go stealth in good conscience, because I'm privileged to have a university position and to know the subject of evolutionary biology. And if it is the source of sort of the, if it's the intellectual license for discrimination and for pathologizing, then it really is my job to do something about that. So, you know, it's hard. We all have our paths. If you, it's interesting talking with women generally, is that I think the life paths of women generally are not as linear as they are for men, seems to me. And so I don't see mine as my life path is more difficult than women who had to escape during the Holocaust, or who had to escape in boats from Vietnam during that war, or who had an abusive husband, or who had any number of things. And so I have had a difficult path, and put up, but not more difficult than other women who have also had difficult paths. And I think that's important, that we not think of ourselves as in terms which are self-indulgent, I guess you could say. And so I don't know if that answers your question. I just accept the way I am.
It's a hard one, isn't it? Maybe it's a bit unfair. I'll tell you what, I'll ask you another question actually as well. Is, if you could change one thing, what do you think it would be?
One thing in the world?
Yeah.
Well, there are a few of them. It's the boiling it down to one, which is the problem. I think probably the single issue that I'd like to change or to solve is to understand the evolution of prejudice and why there is prejudice, and whether animals also show prejudice, which I think they do. And I think the evolution of traits like the peacock's tail is really the bodily manifestation of zoological prejudice, you might say. And prejudice is very interesting because it's always based on arbitrary characteristics which are made to assume a great social significance with implications for access to resources. And in every society, you have groupings forming around arbitrary characteristics which are used for prejudice, you know. And I think that's the flip side of cooperation and of teamwork, is that while there's a lot of cooperation that goes on within the team, then there are also people excluded from the team. And it's that line to affect the exclusion is where the prejudice is lodged. And it's the mechanism for the exclusion. So you can focus on the existence of the cooperation, but you can also focus on the exclusion. And I think that's where prejudice comes from. And I don't know if I would like to, I don't think it would be realistic to say we can't have prejudice. And so I wouldn't say wish that there were no prejudice, but I wish we could understand where prejudice comes from. And it's not just socially constructed. It's biologically motivated, I think, and then realized through social construction. And if we understood that better, I think we would also have a lot less violence, and we'd understand war better.
On which note, shall we go and have a cup of tea? Joan, thank you very much.
Right.